be able to connect this to that, the cable to that. Let me let it drop. Where a lot of the questions is, how do you make that matching deal? Okay, so that's what we're going to get into. In one of the books that is basically known as, in fact, I think I have that copy, it's a book called Radio Antenna Engineering. I believe it was by a guy, I think I got the right one, it was there, Radio Engineering, there was a guy by the name of Laporte, L-A, I think it's P-O-R-T, is that correct, Dick? Over.
I do remember a set of books, a major Bible-like book with that title, with that author. I don't think I've got a copy of that one, though, Mel. Go ahead.
I believe it, because I remember seeing some of these charts in there. They have some very interesting charts. One of the charts he has in there, he tells about if you have a certain, and for a vertical radiator, if you have a certain length of pipe, he, in fact, shows you how to average it out if it's, you know, different diameters, and then come up with a what he called a length to diameter ratio. And for that diameter ratio, he gives then the resistance in ohms and the reactance in ohms. So let me let it drop. So what Jerry did, he looked that up. In fact, later on, he showed that it is fairly close to what the chart shows. It said that if you have approximately 18 feet of pipe up in this particular situation, as I described, it will expand and 300 or J20. So now this is the dilemma you got. How do you take your 50-ohm cable and connect it to this kind of setup, this vertical? How do you connect it to the pipe? And what he did is he looked in the engineering book. Like I say, he adopted a lot of things that were known. He says he admits, he says, I'm not the originator of a lot of these things. I just pulled together. And he said that it showed a ideal way is to use a L network. Okay, now, on with that, you've got two problems, like he explained. You've got a 50-ohm cable, and it's got to go to a 5-ohm radiation resistance in this pipe. How do you do this? So the first thing he did, he says, is very straightforward. He says he uses, let me let it drop. Okay, there's two formulas involved with this. Now I'm going to give you the formulas, and I'll explain them in detail. Formula 1, Z1, Zebra 1, that will be coil number 1. We're going to make two coils, making an L network. Z1 is equal to plus or minus J times the square root of R2. Now, parentheses, and you got R1 minus R2 in the parentheses. Again, I'll repeat the formula. Z1 is equal to plus or minus J, put the square root sign. Under the square root sign, put R2, then put a parenthesis, R1 minus R2, close parenthesis. Now, by using this, he used, I'll explain it in detail. Far, any questions, or you want to make any statement about the formula or whatever? Any critiques? Over.
I know that somebody wants to make a comment, but let's let Mel finish his presentation first. So, formula number one for this L network. And by the way, what an L network consists of is a horizontal inductor and a vertical capacitor. Or a horizontal capacitor and a vertical inductor, that's the usual way of making an L network. And when you design those two components, the L and the C correctly, inductor and capacity, choose the right sizes of those, it can simultaneously give you the impedance match, your 50 ohms down to 5 ohms, if that's what the resistive component of your antenna is, and it's capable of re-resonating the antenna if it's too short. So it can correct everything, so to speak, if it right. So this very simple network can do an awful lot of magic. And Jerry Civic made some darn good use of those. You've given us the first formula, which I think came through pretty good. Z1 equals plus or minus J square root R2 open parentheses R1 minus R2 closed parentheses. The R2 and the parentheses all under the square root sign, if I understand correctly. And proceed and tell us about the second formula and how to use it, and then we'll take comments after that. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Okay, on with this formula. Now, R1 in the formula is the resistance or the impedance of the transmission line. In this case, he's using RG8. He was using 50 ohms. The R2 is the radiation resistance of the antenna. Like I said, they showed him in the chart. 5 ohms for an 18-foot piece of pipe. That's the average. Yeah, you can, you know, say the taper and all that stuff, they got all that in there, but okay, he says it's close enough for considering, you know, what he had there, his 18 foot. So he used that 5 ohm, in this case, for the 18 foot of pipe. He solved this equation. If you solve it, you put it in, you got the minus J factor in there. You know it's 320 ohms. They gave you that. That's a minus 320. It's minus J 320. Is the factor also they gave you besides the 5 ohms that's in the chart. Like I say, if you're going to use a different length of pipe, you can look up this chart and just substitute in these figures. So you've got the minus J, square root of 5, open parentheses, 50, minus 5, closed parentheses. And you get to, the answer will come out to minus J, 15. Minus J 15. Let me let it drop. Okay, so that'll take care of situation one. The next situation you've got there is that you see that the pipe will, as exhibited according to the chart, 320 ohms of reactive, capacitive reactance. Now you got to make another coil to fix this situation up. It's capacitive, you got to put an inductor. So I'm going to give you another formula, another simple, straight formula. Z2, that'll be coil number 2, will be plus or minus J, that's the reactance, times R1, square root, and then the square root, R2, divided by R1 minus R2. That's all under the square root. Again, I'll say it again. Z2, is equal to plus or minus J times R1. Now take the square root, and under the square root put R2 divided by R1 minus R2. That's fairly clear, Dick. Over.
One slight ambiguity there, Mel. Z2 equals plus or minus J R1 open square root sign R2 divided by R1 minus R2. Is R1 minus R2 all under the R2, or is there an R2 divided by R1 end the fraction, then minus R2 under the square root sign? So the second R2, is it all in the denominator? Is the denominator R1 minus R2, or is the denominator only R1? And then completely separately is the minus R2 out to the side, but under the square root sign. That wasn't quite clear, Mel. Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay. We have outside plus or minus J times R1. That's outside. Now make the square root sign. And under the square root, in the square root sign, put R2 as the numerator. And under it, the denominator, I don't want to confuse people, but under R2, make a line, and then put R1 minus R2. This is all under the square root sign, Dick. Over.
Yes, it's all under the square root sign. But is the denominator of that fraction, open parentheses, R1 minus R2, closed parentheses, is that the total denominator, R1 minus R2? Over to you, Mel.
Actually, yes, it is. In fact, it's going to come out to R2, as we said, with 5 ohms resistive over 50 ohms, which is R1, minus 5 ohms. That's exactly what you're going to see under the parentheses when you substitute the numbers in, Dick, over.
Okay, so the R2 minus R1, correction, R1 minus R2 factor, the R1 minus R2 factor is a complete denominator only in that formula. That the second R2 does not hang to the right of the fraction, if you know what I mean. The wording on that could be misinterpreted. Back to you, Mel.
Sorry. Okay. Yes, under the parentheses now, if you substitute it, you'll see you'll have the square root of 5 line, and then you'll have 50 minus 5. Exactly. That's exactly what you'll see under the parentheses. So that R1 minus R2 is one part of the denominator. It's all one. In other words, you're doing that calculation. So you're going to wind up at 5 over 45, actually. The square root of 5 over 45. So solving this, you will get equal to plus 16.7. That is what it will be when you solve this equation. Now, armed with these two things, let me let it drop. Okay, so what he did now, he's taken these two factors. Now, the first one he took, you want to now, well, we want to take this factor that we have of 16.7, and we want to get it into really something we can work with, an inductor. Well, we want to make a coil out of it. So to find out approximately what the coil would require a coil, he took the factor, and now another formula that we're going to use, and that's X of L is equal to 2 pi FL. X of L is equal to 2 pi FL. That's another formula. Now, what we're going to do with this formula, let me leave it at that. I hope I didn't confuse anybody, but this is what we're going to do with the 16.7. The first thing we just solved, Dick, over.
Yep, that's the general formula for inductive reactance of a coil once you know the frequency that you're operating at. And by the way, this pi, this L network, where you talked about plus or minus J for the first formula, the Z1, and the plus or minus J for the Z2, most of the L networks, you'll choose positive for one and negative for the other. That's a fancy way of saying it's one inductor and one capacitor. And whether the inductor comes first and the capacitor is second or vice versa, both will work in theory, but depending on your particular situation, one is almost always easier to the other, both in values that are available and size of components, as well as whether or not you're simultaneously correcting a reactance for the antenna. So you haven't said it yet, but I bet you might be going to say that you'll make one of those a positive J and the other one a negative J, quite possibly. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, I wasn't going to get into that, but yeah, Dick brought up a good point that basically what you're looking at, it would be minus J. That's the first one we solved was minus J15. The second one we solved, that was Z1. We solved Z1 came out to minus J15. Second one we solved is plus J16.7, Dick, over.
Okay, so we now know the magnitude of those reactances. And now, what size coil and what size capacitor are those? A guy can either go to the reactance charts that are in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, that's one approach, or with a handheld calculator and the formula for inductive reactance and capacitor reactance, you can calculate it. Either way, a smart guy will do both. He will calculate it with his calculator and come up with some number of microhenries. Then, just to make sure he hasn't slipped some decimal places, he will double-check the answer with the reactance chart that's in the first couple of chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. That's my recommendation. I bet you've done it that way yourself, Mel, just to be double darn sure. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, K2KEY, yeah. I've been doing that with a slide rule for many years. Many times I do it. All right, let's stick to what we're doing here. All right, we had this 16.7 plus 16.7 that we solved for, let's say, Z2. We like to, like you say, make the coil now. So using the formula X of L equals to 2 pi FL, we put in at 16.7, which equals to, at this point, we know the reactance is X of L, is that the reactance, 16.7, is what we solved for previously. We put that into the formula of 2 pi, now, times, at this point, he used the frequency, he is about the middle of the CW band, just for reference, at 7 megahertz, 7.037 megahertz at the time, that was 40 meters, times 10 to the 6th power times L1. And when you solve this, if you'll see that it will come out to 0.378 microhenries. Again, X of L equals 2 pi FL. In this case, we know the reactance of 16.7. Let me let it drop. The 16.7 equals to 2 pi. Frequency that you are going to be using at this point, he was using 7 megahertz, 7.037 he asked to pick out because he was interested in the CW portion of the band, times 10 to the 6th power times L1. Remember, everything is going to be in microhenries, whereas the formula actually, when you say 2 pi FL, you'll ask me why 10 to the 6th. Let me explain that. The formula, 2 pi FL, L is in henries. Henries a big chunk, you know, compared to what we're using. We're using a very small part of the henry. And so it's coming out to point. This way the decimal point will fall in the right place. And it'll come out to 0.378 microhenry. So far, everybody, I think, understood this. Stick over.
Yeah, I walked along with you and did that on my handheld calculator, and I calculated for 7.1 megacycles, 40-meter band, and I ended up with 0.374. Close enough, but it's 0.37-something microhenries. And each of those formulas, like Mel was saying, you have to put in frequency in hertz, and inductance in henries, and capacitance in farads. Even those are crazy-sounding numbers, that's what makes the formula work right, and then you figure out later on what size real inductor you're going to wind. And now Mel may be going to tell you what page you go to in order to wind an inductor of that size if you're going to homebrew it, or maybe it's one of the popular sizes you can buy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, Jerry being the homebrewer, he went ahead and he says, well, he took this 0.378 microhenry, and if you look in the chart, ARR, Hell Handbook, any of them, the chart, they give you ideal. What would be ideal for this situation? And ideally, they said that a coil approximately requires around 2.7 turns. 2.7 turns if the diameter of the coil is 3 inches. In other words, if you want to use a standard or you want to wind your own. 2.7 turns. And the series coil solved the same way, you know, solving the other coil, came out to 6.9 microhenry. And that required 18 turns on a 3-inch diameter. About 9 inches long. This is all in the handbook. He wound it. He said he had some number 10 wire around, so he just used a 3-inch form and he wound the coil deck over.
I vaguely remember the Z1 turned out to be 15 ohms, and Z2 turned out to be 16.7 ohms. If they were both an inductor, that would suggest that they're kind of similar looking. But I'm a little confused now. Is this particular L network just two separate inductors, not one of them a capacitor, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry if I confused you. Yes, when you solve the formula, the second formula, the same way, the X of L equals 2 pi FL. Yes, they are both inductors. One came out to 0.378 microhenries, and the other one came out to 6.9 microhenries. Dick, one is the series coil, and one is the shunt coil, right, and L network. Maybe I didn't make that clear. I apologize. One is the series coil, and the other one is the shunt coil, and they both were wound with number 10 copper wire. Over.
Okay, give me once again Z2, the second formula, turned out to be J16.7 ohms. I thought you told me Z1 turned out to be 15 ohms. Maybe I remember that wrong. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, it came out to minus J15, over.
Okay, if Z1 is the first coil at 15 ohms, Z2 is the second coil at 16 ohms, and Z2 is 3/10 of a microhenry, how can Z1, which is almost the same reactance, be 6.9 microhenry? I'm a little confused by that one. Now, go ahead.
Okay, well, you've got to remember one thing. We are dealing with a series, known as the series arm situation here. So the formula for the other coil, the 6.9, that would be the other coil that we're talking about, it would be L2, it would be 305 ohm resistance, reactance, because remember, we're taking this as the reactants and substituting it in. The X of L would equal to 2 pi, follow along, 2 pi times 7.037 times 10 to the 6th power times L. You follow that, Dick?
Yeah, let me back up a little bit. What is the number of ohms of reactants of Z1? Go ahead.
Hey, number of ohms of the reactants of Z1 is minus J15. That's 50 ohm transmission line for 5 ohm radiation resistor of the antenna. And that comes out to minus J15, over.
Okay. Z1 is going to be 15 ohms of reactants. Z2 is going to be 16 ohms of reactants. That's only a couple of percent difference. Almost identical. How can one be 3/10 of a microhenry and the other be 6.9 microhenry? If they're supposed to be so close in reactance, how can the microhenries be so different? I'm a little confused by that one, Melvin.
This is K2KEY. I was at sure first a little confused also, Vic. But if you look at if you draw a picture of the complete matching network, the capacitive reactance of, let's call Z1, is in a series with the added inductive reactance of the plus 320. You follow that, first of all.
Okay. I guess I missed that one. So the 320 ohms of inductive reactance, or capacitive reactance of the antenna. Yes, 320, and you've got to cancel that. I'm slowly catching on. So in other words, that leg of the pi network, which includes the antenna, has to come out 15 ohms, and so you want 15 ohms of inductive reactance left over after you cancel the capacitor reactance of the antenna. I didn't catch that the first time around. I think I've got it now. Back to you, Mel.
Exactly. So the effective of the series arm, so we have 320 ohms capacitive reactance minus J320. Thus, the effective series arm of minus J 15 that we solved for by Z1, and the 320 will come out to 305. So we have approximately, by using the network, in other words, we have to have a network that comes out to approximately a shunt network that has to come out to about, that comes out to about 305 ohms of network that we have to now provide for. That's why I recommend people look at, let me address. If this sounds like a little bit of a mystery, just look, I'm just giving you an idea. Look up an L network, you'll understand basically what's going on with the L network. So, you just do this basic math and then just substitute these figures in, but if you have a little bit of idea that you're not understanding exactly what's happening, look at the L network. We got to remember that the capacitive reactance of Z1 is in series with the inductive reactance of the 320. So, you know, you got to remember that we have to balance. We got capacitive reactance. Okay, let me see if I can put it in the right word. We have a capacitive reactance. 5 ohms, the pipe exhibits, minus J320, which means it's 320 capacitive reactance. We want to balance this out, so we need 320 ohms of inductive reactance. So, is that the best way to say it, Dick? Over.
It's pretty good, and I'm going to add a couple of words to it. In the case of an L network, you normally, in this particular case, we happen to have a horizontal capacitor and a vertical inductor. Where that capacitor and inductor come together, that's where you're connecting the 50-ohm coax cable. That's the high impedance point, that's the 50-ohm point. Now, that capacitor on the horizontal component, on the far end of that capacitor, away from the junction where you connected the coax cable, is where you're going to connect the antenna. The equivalent circuit of the antenna is in series with that horizontal capacitor. And by the way, the bottom of the inductor gets grounded. Let me drop. The equivalent circuit of the antenna is a 320 ohm capacitor in series with a 5 ohm resistor. So the total circuit is the equivalent of the antenna, 320 ohms capacitance, 5 ohms of resistance, in series with your horizontal capacitor. Then comes the junction of the inductor to ground, and that junction also has the center conductor of the coax cable. The shield of the coax cable goes to ground. And now, that horizontal arm, in order for the Pi network to work correctly, the horizontal arm has to work out a total of 15 ohms of capacitance. You've already got 320 ohms of capacitance of the antenna. And you've got to cancel that first. The net result is the horizontal arm, what you're plugging in there, really is an inductor. But when it's all put together, it's going to act like a capacitor. So it is a Pi, it is an L network of horizontal capacitor, shunt inductor, and it's peculiar looking because you're simultaneously resonating the antenna as well as impedance matching the resistive component. This might be a little bit heavy for beginners, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, but the coils are very simple. If you look at in the ARRL handbook or anything, they'll show you how easy it is to fashion a coil, like I say, for if you want to do the experiment. And you'd say the math is throwing you a little bit. If you were to, let me put it this way. If you stuck a piece of pipe up in the air approximately somewhere in that neighborhood of length, and it's a little longer, it's a couple of feet long, let's say you took a 10-foot piece of television mast and you stuck it up on the same arrangement, and you made two coils up like this, one coil for 2.7 turns, 3 inches long, another coil with 18 turns, on a 3-inch form, and you hook that up very simply. One is the shunt coil, one is the series coil. You take your SWR bridge up there with you. You squeeze the coil a little this way, bend it a little this way. I think you'll get a good match eventually. You'll see, I think, as Jerry did that, that's what he followed up with. That's what he did. He played around with it, bending the coils this way and that way. And he says, I know. He says that most likely the exact resistance of the pipe and everything in the layout was not exactly 5 ohms and 320 ohms reactive capacitor. He says, but by manipulating the coils then a little bit, he says, I got it to go to 1.5 to 1 tick over.
And if he's willing to spend the time, he can do a little bit better. What's going on here is that the calculation, knowing the length of the pipe and the frequency you're operating at, and the size of the ground plane and so on, the physical layout, he estimated what the antenna impedance would be, 320 ohms of capacitance in series with 5 ohms of resistance. He did a rough approximation calculation for what size of two inductors, one shunt and one in series, will give an impedance match. The magic about winding a coil out of 14-gauge wire or whatever it was, is that when you squeeze the coil together, make the turns a little bit tighter, the inductance increases. Stretch the coil, and not all of the magnetic field links all the turns, and therefore the inductive reactance decreases. So a poor man's variable inductor of very high performance is an air-wound coil, 3 inches in diameter is what Mel told us, and as you squeeze and stretch it while watching your standing wave ratio bridge, let me drop, and you can either do the experiment at 1 watt if your standing wave ratio bridge is sensitive enough, and with 1 watt going into the circuit, you can put your hands on the coil, and while your hand is there, you're disturbing it, but at 1 watt, you're not likely to damage your hand. Do it at 100 watts, and I recommend you turn off the transmitter each time you go over there to squeeze or stretch the coil, then turn the transmitter back on and see if it got better or worse. It's like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill, if you know what I mean. You can tell when you're going in the right direction because the readings get better. But at the 1 watt or 100 milliwatt level, there's no real danger. You can go over there and squeeze the coil. Just don't pay any attention to the reading while your hand is on the coil. Or if you want to, you can make a set of wooden tweezers, so to speak, wooden tongs, and squeeze and stretch the coil without having any reactance of your hand there, nearby, any reaction of your hand, and watch the readings get better or worse. So if he's willing to stretch and squeeze those coils in the right combination, he could have made the standing wave ratio even better than that if he wanted to. But 1.5 to 1 is more than good enough, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger. Yeah, well, he used a handheld, antenna analyzer, which many people have today that's so reasonably priced today that either you got, you're the one person that's doing this experimental habit, or his friend will have one, somebody, or in a club, somebody's always got one of those antenna analyzers, so you sit there right at the base of the antenna. The only thing, of course, like he stressed, he says, mount the coils at right angles to each other. This way, he says, there won't be any conflict in coupling between the two coils, while you're, playing around with them especially. So he rigged this up. Very simple. Like I say, nothing complicated here. If you start out with basically what he did, you're most likely going to have the same effect. Now you've got this antenna up there, and you can see. Does this antenna make you happy? There's a vertical. If you want to change bands or something like that, well, you can manipulate these coils or whatever around. Look in the handbook and substitute these. Figure, just have to change the frequency from 7 megahertz. You want to make one for 20, make for 10, make one for 80, whatever the heck you want. Just change the frequency into the formula. And then look up what's required to make a coil for an L network. And, I drop in the handbook, and you can wind it, whatever, or modify the coil that you got there, or what the heck else. But you'll see now, for a few bucks, you'll put this to rest. If you like the way this one of these antennas works, and try it on, like I say, a few bands, and then want to plunk down your money, fine. But in summary, as Jerry said, the short vertical will give a fairly good account of itself. I'm quoting. But he says it will not perform anywhere like a 65-foot vertical with 120 radials. In other words, a radial every 3 degrees. He says, don't look for it to perform at that. He says, but he says if you're in a situation with, situation where you don't have the money, like you say, that people that can just write out the check and be in ham's heaven, and that's another story, but that's what he wanted to do. Bare bones experiment, Dick. Over.
Now, let me zoom back on this situation, because there's a lot of education here, in my opinion, Mel. If you open up the classic books on an antenna, and you're deciding to build a vertical quarter-wave ground plane antenna, by definition, at 40 meters, that vertical radiator should be a quarter wavelength long. Quarter wavelength long is around 32 feet. What Jerry Civic did is decide that 32 feet is too big for the piece of pipe he had available and the amount of hardware he was willing to install into his small backyard. And he chose a smaller piece of vertical radiator pipe. And one of the things that Mel and I have been telling everybody for lots of time is that you can make an antenna any length you want. That's a hard one to believe. But once you recognize that you can make the antenna any length you want, let me drop. Your first requirement is to make the antenna electronically a resonant length. You resonate first, then you can radiate. So this piece of pipe was too short. If you went to the Brown and Woodward curves that are in Chapter 4 of almost every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4 has a set of reactance and resistance curves for any length of monopole at any reasonable diameter. Mr. Brown and Woodward, back in 1946, spent a man year making all those measurements. Real pieces of metal at real frequencies on a real ground plane, they measured it. Not a calculation, a measurement. That's hardcore data. You choose your particular length of pipe at your particular diameter, and if you want to, you go to the Brown and Woodward curve, and in this example, you would probably find out the antenna calculates to have it measures on that curve to have a 5-ohm resistive component and a 320-ohm capacitive reactance component. You got to get rid of the capacitive reactance first. That's what resonance means. The impedance of the antenna no longer has any capacitive or inductive reactance. It's got nothing but a resistor when you resonate it. And so one of the steps of this procedure of making this L network is to first force the antenna into electronic resonance.
Profitable secret for those who have it. And then, you know, it's in their interest not to have people get into panic mode, obviously. What they want are people to shut up, do as they're told, get in line, go to work, make their money, get taxed, and, you know, all that stuff. So they don't really want a...
I think that's the best way to control a large group of people is religion. I mean, when you look at all the points and issues towards it, it keeps everybody killing, stealing, you know, doing everything they should
do. Yeah.
And that's why I think that they won't expose it. And, I mean, I think it could help us, because I'd love to have a spaceship to go to Hawaii, surf in 5 minutes, come back and get ready to go to work. You know, that would be great. No gas, no, you know, it'd be wonderful.
And there are many, many of us, sometimes in certain days, I believe this too, who think that the technology is there, that it's been worked at secretly and the breakthroughs have been made. But that perhaps the secret keepers feel that it's not in the interests, not in their interests, that the rest of us poor slobs get access to that stuff.
Let's go to Dallas, Texas. John, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John.
Oh, thank you, George, for taking my call.
Of course.
I am very excited to get on. I've had an encounter twice in my life, visited by the same craft, once when I was in the third grade and once again when I was 19 years old, and I've never really been able to talk to anybody about it that didn't think I was a lunatic.
Well, you'll give us an overview, John.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, the first time I grew up in Midland, Texas, and it's, you know, it's kind of sparse out there, and my friend lived out in the country, and he and I used to like to get his dad's pop-up camper and, you know, camp out. And this one night we were just about ready to go to bed, and it was probably about 2 a.m. We'd been up playing guns and whatever you do. And the next thing we know, we heard this tremendous, like, thrusting noise. Mm-hmm. And it literally started shaking the trailer. Like, the trailer was vibrating. And we stepped outside and looked up, and there was a very large, cigar-shaped object hovering about 100 feet above our heads. It had lights that flashed in sequence down the middle of the craft. And if I believe, I think they were even different colors. And they would just flash like in a pattern.
So you were a boy. Can you give an idea of what year approximately this would have been, or what time?
That should have been about 1978,
okay.
The first one.
Okay.
And anyway, we actually ran inside because we wanted to grab binoculars and get a better look at this thing. And when we came back out, it was off far enough on the horizon where it's like we could see it, but it was just a tiny little thing at this point, and we couldn't, you know, really see it with the binoculars. And so it had just, you know, I don't know how far away it was, but it was plenty far away in a very short amount of time. And then later on, when I was 19, I was coming home from my girlfriend's house about 2 a.m. I pulled into my driveway, and I was shutting off my car, and my car started vibrating. And immediately I thought it was my stereo system, and I'm trying to figure out how this thing's still, you know, on.
You had the right. Bass up too high, right?
Yeah, that's immediately what I thought it was, and I shut it off. It was still vibrating, and then I noticed some flashing lights next to me, and I glanced, and I thought that I was like, well, somebody's got pulled over, and I just turned around to see if someone had been pulled over down the street, and there was nobody on the street. And I looked back at my sister's car where the lights were flashing off of it, and I realized they were flashing off the top of the car.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I got out of my car again, or not again, but I got out of my car, I looked up, and it was hovering above me again.
It was the same type of craft?
Same type of craft. I remember everything was the same. It was the lights flashing down the middle. It seemed to be roughly 100 feet in the air. This was a very large object, too. I can't
say larger than a typical airplane then?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and then also with the, you know, the only thing that I could have possibly thought maybe it was some kind of a blimp, but blimps don't all of a sudden disappear and end up,
no,
20 miles away. And because I did exactly the same thing again, I ran inside, I grabbed binoculars, and I came out because I wanted to get to see this thing. And once again, it had disappeared on the horizon. I got into my car and drove after it, and it just stayed far enough away from me that I couldn't get any closer to see it.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah.
I love these cases. Let's take one or two more calls, Richard, then we're out of time.
Yeah, one thing about that gentleman's case, I'll just say, 1978 was when this first one was a nearly, what you call, a UFO pandemic year. It was a massive year of activity.
78.
It's all in my next book. It was just all over the world, and lots of sightings that year of beings. Hundreds of reports of being sightings. Just interesting stuff. And then the other thing you notice is that there's, you know, in the old days, people would really be very suspicious of someone who saw multiple UFOs, or like multiple times in their life, and you find it's not necessarily an unusual thing, or multiple experiences.
Okay, let's take one more call, maybe two. We'll go to you, wildcard line, Tony in California. Hey, Tony.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Hello, Tony.
Thanks.
Yeah, I live out here in Ridgecrest, Mojave Desert, near the China Lake. You guys know that's at?
Oh, yeah.
I'm in law enforcement out here, and over the last few years, lots of good stuff up in the sky out here. Has it been a hotbed in the past?
Well, yes, China Lake has a long history. I mean, a good 20 years at least of people seeing some crazy things out that way. The whole region stretching, just going east of Los Angeles, going right out to Nevada. There's a lot of aviation, aerospace manufacturer out there, of course.
You got Edwards, China Lake, and then you got Nellis to the east.
You bet. I mean, back when Area 51 was first getting known about, I mean, back in the late 1980s, at the same time, there were a lot of people who were hanging out down in the Antelope Valley and out by where you are, studying bizarre aircraft, boomerang shape, triangle shape, saucer shape, that many of them appeared to be associated with the various bases and facilities in that area. So there's been a lot of speculation since that time that some of these things are being manufactured by us. Now, the interesting thing about that is that these stories go back a good 20 years, basically 20 years, from the late 1980s.
Richard, you're a great researcher, my friend.
We're out of time.
I'll see you Friday in Las Vegas. Come on by. You know it.
You know it. I'm looking for it. I bid you a good night.
Absolutely. If you need more information on this Las Vegas event, it's the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, ufoconference.com. For Kiris Coburn, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.
This number could mean thousands of extra dollars in your pocket. Do you have any gold or diamond jewelry, pocket or wristwatches, gold or silver coins, stamps or coin collections, silver flatware, old autographs or letters, baseball cards, memorabilia, etc.? If you do, call the world-famous Plaza Galleries at 145 West 57th Street in New York City for a free appraisal and high cash offer. Plaza will evaluate everything you have and, in most cases, pay you much more than you think your items are worth. Plaza is paying record-high prices for all wristwatches and pocket watches, including all Rolex, Patek Philippe, Vacheron, Cartier, Tiffany, Breguet, IWC, Piaget, Universal Genevieve, Breitling, as well as others in any condition. They are also paying record high prices for all gold and diamond jewelry, estate pieces, stamp collections, and basically anything of value. And they'll also travel to your home for appraisals. Call Plaza Galleries at 212-246-2000, 212-246-2000, or out of state call toll free 1-800-772-0054, 1-800-772-0054.
Don't waste another breath. Introducing Kick the Habit Now, the smoking cessation company that pioneered laser therapy in the tri-state. You know it, and the people that love you know it. It's time to quit smoking. You've seen the commercials on TV telling you how harmful cigarettes are, but they don't offer you a way to quit. We have the answer that works. Kick the Habit Now has a program that stimulates the chemicals you deplete from smoking, taking away your need to smoke. It's safe, painless, and effective. You're well aware how damaging your smoking is to you and the people around you. Now, there's even another reason to quit smoking. The price is going up $1.50 per pack. What is your breaking point? Kick the Habit Now also offers companies help for their employees, families, and friends to stop smoking now. They'll come right to your office, big or small, helping you increase productivity, health, and morale. 80% of people who have gone through this program say it is terrific and successful. Kick the Habit Now offers laser therapy for weight loss, too. Call 212-292-5660. That's 212-292-5660. Or check their website at kickthehabitnow.com. That's kickthehabitnow.com. I'm a Simma Morning with...